I'm going to call the joint hearing to order, Senate Environmental Natural Resource Finance Committee and the Senate Environment and Natural Resource Policy and Legacy Finance Committee. Welcome, everybody, the 15th of January. Our first hearing this year, members. I thought first we would start out with introductions, but I think we're going to eliminate that. I think everybody knows everybody here, except we do have two members. Two new members. Senator Root, I know, has a new member on her committee, Jeff Howe, who's not here. And we have Senator Abler on the Finance Committee, who happens not to be here. So the two chairs will be having a discussion with the new members before the day's end. And nobody wants to meet him anyway, I've heard. So, but you all know them as well. So, again, welcome. Today we're going to be talking and looking into the issue of CWD here in Minnesota, which has gotten to be somewhat of a hot topic, at least in my neck of the woods, as well as I think just overall in general with all sportsmen, outdoorsmen in the state of Minnesota. And I know also the concerns of the Cervidae farms that we have here. In our state, and so we're going to pull together today the DNR for some testimony, as well as the Board of Animal Health, and so we can get a little better grasp on what's going on, what kind of an issue we have. We know that Wisconsin has, and the testifiers can talk about Wisconsin or neighboring states as to what they're experiencing with this, and it's a very important thing when you have 500,000 hunters enter the woods every year. In pursuit of the whitetail here in Minnesota, which has again been a heritage for years. That 500,000 is a small number, actually, when you talk about family gatherings and cabins and those types of things. So I for one, and I know Senator Root takes it very seriously, and we want to make sure that we can get on top of this. So Senator Root, any opening comments at all? Okay. All right, we'll start out with the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources, Bob Meyer, and Lou Cornicelli, Wildlife Research Manager. I'm not sure either one of them needs too many introductions. I think everybody knows who they are. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, Madam Chair. For the record, Bob Meyer, Assistant Commissioner, Department of Natural Resources, and I have here with me Dr. Lou Cornicelli to go through our efforts in managing chronic wasting disease in Minnesota. And I do really appreciate your introductory comments, Mr. Chairman. I don't know if any of us could imagine what your community would look like without the impact of deer hunting in the fall, the economic benefits, and also managing the herd. We are getting to a point where this is a very serious issue in southern Minnesota. And if we do not continue our activities, and Dr. Cornicelli and his staff try to get their arms around this issue, the deer hunting in Fillmore County, as we know it today, may not exist. So we should be very serious about this issue. I know you are as well, as serious as we have been in the past about bovine tuberculosis, avian influenza, and other diseases that are out there. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I'm going to turn the presentation over to Dr. Cornicelli, and we'll be able to answer any questions as we go forward.
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, thank you for the opportunity to present. I'm going to kind of go through a lot of information, so I hopefully it's not too much, but I was asked to give you an overview of what we've been doing for the last few years. I'm sorry, for the record, Lou Cornicelli, Wildlife Research Manager, Minnesota DNR. Apologize for that. It is the first hearing of the year. So so just a brief background, chronic wasting disease is a slowly progressive brain disease of the cervid family, deer, elk, moose, and reindeer. It belongs to the family of what they call transmissible spongiform encephalopathies. The other species that have these types of diseases are sheep and scrapie, cows is bovine spongiform encephalopathy or mad cow disease. In humans, it's Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease, but they're all the same class of diseases or prions. It's not a virus, a fungus, or a bacteria. It can't be killed by cooking or any kind of normal sterilization methods. So it's a very different pathogen than what we're used to dealing with wildlife and human diseases. Chronic wasting disease and the mechanism prion transmission differed depending on the species. In the case of cervids, it's spread deer to deer. So it's bodily fluids, feces, urine, saliva. One of the challenges we have with this disease is that you can't look at an animal and say this animal is clinically ill. They generally look like any other deer that are out there. We don't see the symptoms until right at the end stage of disease, so the last few months before the animal dies. Up until that time, they look fairly normal. If you look at the presentation, the picture on the upper right is a CWD-positive deer from 2016. The picture on the lower right is a CWD-positive deer. The lower right one's easy. The upper right one is really difficult. So it's very hard to say this animal has this disease. The characteristics of a lot of the TSEs, the neurological, dementia, incoordination, loss of body condition, behavior, so pretty standard symptoms. We know that there's no treatment or vaccine, and the disease is always fatal one way or the other. These prions exist for a long time in the environment, which is a concern for us. You know, with our freeze-thaw cycles, they have no effect on inactivity of prions. They can persist for a very long time, thereby infecting animals environmentally when prevalence is high. There's no genetic immunity. We've heard a lot about resistance and such, but there's really no immunity that's known with this disease. Once an animal contracts the prions or contracts the disease, eventually they'll die either proximately or ultimately from the disease. We know that the disease is at least now not known to infect humans or cattle, but the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention recommend that you don't eat an animal that has a prion disease, and we support that recommendation. This is actually our Pine Island CWD-positive deer from 2010. The hunter got it on a trail camera a couple days before he harvested it. Why is it important? Right now, we're up to 25 states, three Canadian provinces. The disease is widespread. We'll talk about Fillmore County, Winona County here, or Houston County, rather. The Board of Animal Health will address the farm-servant disease issues. But basically, it's found in a lot of states. The prevalence is growing. The distribution is spreading. And it's a concern to a lot of us. And we'll get into carcass export and import restrictions. And this is really why, because the disease is showing up in new places all the time. Most recently, northern Mississippi, southern Tennessee, just about between 2 weeks and a month ago. So we get these new areas. So that's why we talk a lot about it, restricting importing carcasses, because we can't keep up with the number of places that have the disease. Our feeling and the feeling of most wild, or if not all, state wildlife professionals is that things really are not okay with this disease. Given it's 100% fatal, we know from research in other states and also in Wisconsin, close to us, that animals that are infected with the disease have higher mortality rates than animals that are not infected. So in other words, they're more inclined to die of some other cause when they're infected with this disease. We know that males have the disease at 3 times the rate of females. We also know that yearling males, based on their biology, can spread the disease across large landscapes in a relatively short period of time, so they can deliver the prion to new places. We also know that the percentage of animals that are infected increases annually without active and pretty intense management. In other states, particularly the western states, it's taken a long time to get there, but they're starting to see negative population responses as a result of the disease. And I do think that Wisconsin is going to be there here sooner rather than later with their prevalence rates, and I'll talk a little bit about that. Wisconsin is we often hear that, well, no, we don't see these deer die. The disease doesn't kill deer. But Wisconsin's kind of come up with a term they call droolers and shakers. And for lack of a better term, these are deer that are showing up in people's yards that are at the very end clinical stage of disease. And they see more and more of those every year. We've only had 4 found dead deer with CWD in our state, but we would expect the same thing if the disease takes hold. So what are we trying to do? You know, we're really trying to avoid this situation where Wisconsin has an established endemic disease. They're seeing increasing prevalence rates of all age and sex classes. And if you look at the graph, you can see that the disease kind of percolates for a long time. And then at some point, without active management, it increases to a high rate and an increasing rate. So our concern and our aggressive response, whether it's as Mr. Meyer talked about, bovine tuberculosis is a great example. An aggressive early response is really the only way to eliminate disease. And we don't want to end up, unfortunately, like where Wisconsin is right now. And that's why you see a lot of what we're doing. To back up a little bit of history, a lot of the members have seen this slide. In 2002, we started a three-year statewide surveillance program as a response to the CWD-positive deer in Wisconsin in the wild, and then in farms, and then the Aitkin County elk farm in August of 2002. So we rolled out a statewide surveillance program, and again, knowing very little about the disease, where it was found, where it was established across the upper Midwest. And we ended up doing 28,000 samples in a statistically based sampling design. We found no positives. And since 2002, we've actually tested about 60,000 deer. So in 2005, the budget realities are we can't just do surveillance across the state year after year after year. It's very expensive. So we looked at more of a risk-based surveillance strategy. So we measure risk in three different ways. One, are deer that are suspect. Are they showing clinical signs of the disease? A new infection found in an adjacent state, in Wisconsin and Iowa, certainly fit that mold. And then positives that are associated with captive servant facilities. So we typically do surveillance around those facilities as part of our risk-based surveillance program. And right now we've got three that we're doing surveillance around currently. So, you know, why did we go back to the southeast in 2016? Well, I'm going to skip over Pine Island, but we found the disease in close association with the elk farm in Olmsted County. We did 3 years of surveillance. We never found another positive deer. And then so we discontinued our surveillance program. In 2014, Alamakee County, Iowa, was positive, so we did surveillance in Houston and Fillmore counties and found nothing. Took 2015 off, decided that we would go back in 2016 and do the southeast again, partly because of the new Wisconsin positives, the Iowa positives. So we went back in 2016, and sure enough, we found the disease in Fillmore County near Preston. To gloss over it, in 2016, we did a very large-scale surveillance program across the southeast, found the disease in Preston, narrowed the scope of surveillance down to what we call a CWD management zone, which still exists today, and found a couple of more positives in that zone. Got into a program of landowner shooting permits and USDA postseason removals or culling, and we found a few more positives around Preston. So from the beginning of November to November 2016 to March 2017, we tested a little over 4,000 deer and found 11 positives, all clustered in that Preston area, one male a little bit north, but really all centered around Preston. So you take the surveillance from a broad brush, you narrow it down, and this is where we have disease.
I'm sorry. Yep. Tom Sony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So how significant is 11 out of 4,145?
Senator Connerson.
Mr. Chair, Senator Tomasoni, we think it's very significant because, as I noted with the Wisconsin slide, that the longer the disease exists, the percentage of positives increase. I think that we did find the disease early. The fact that in that year and then 2017, we didn't find anything outside our core would indicate that we found it early in the infection state. It's important because we don't want the disease to get established. Our concern is long-term deer populations, and we know that one leads to more over a period of years. So it's very significant. It's a low prevalence, I agree, so a low percent of animals infected, but it's important from the perspective that we have the disease and it exists on the landscape. Does that answer your question, sir?
Well, yeah, I don't think it's significant either, but it's at least not statistically. So then how do we control it? Is what the issue is. How do we stop it if we can?
Mr. Chair, Senator Tomasoni, the way we control it is, and hopefully I'll get to some of that in the presentation, is looking at limiting our risk, and some of that's reducing deer populations in the local area. Some of it is reducing the opportunity for males to travel outside the area to establish new disease nodes. So we kind of look at it from multiple perspectives of both population reduction and managing for a lower age class. But that's the basic premise, is that you have two mechanisms of disease transmission going on or disease maintenance going on. You have female social groups that exist in smaller areas, let's just say Preston, and then you have males that would pick up the disease in that local area and then spread it to new areas. So the way we do it is lowering deer densities and also looking for opportunities to mitigate live animal movement.
So, Mr. Chairman, so how do you pick the people who get to shoot the deer? It's okay. You don't have to answer that one.
Cornicelli.
Mr. Chair, Senator Tomasoni, we offer broad, broad long seasons and liberal bag limits. One of our challenges, and I'll get to that towards the end, is private land, access to private land. So we don't particularly choose the people who get to hunt or harvest deer, but we set up a mechanism to make it easy for people to do so.
Maybe you're going to get to all this, but so does this work? Do we know if it works? I mean, we have any indication from other states or other countries that by spreading out the deer that it actually controls the disease?
Mr. Cornicelli.
Mr. Chair, Senator Tomasoni, yes, there are, and I think you could look to this state for two of those examples. In northwestern Minnesota, when bovine TB tuberculosis was found in that area in beef cattle, then in deer, we implemented some pretty aggressive responses to that disease, with the goal of lowering densities, reducing contact of deer and cattle, reducing contact among deer, and create an environment that the disease could never take hold. And we did that aggressive management really from 2005 to 2012, and the state was able to regain their bovine TB-free status. And we are held up as a model for that response with that disease. In 2009, with the CWD-positive elk farm in Pine Island, same thing. We did risk-based surveillance. We found one positive deer. We had a very aggressive response to that disease, and we never found another positive. Did we kill the only positive one? I don't know, but I think we created an environment where the densities were lowered enough that the disease was not able to get to establish itself. The other example is New York. They had the same thing, the same kind of dynamic of deer discovery. They found a couple positives. They did very aggressive harvest for several years, and they haven't found the disease either. So yes, it does work. The key is to be in the early stage of infection. We only have a few positives. The geographic landscape is limited. That's your chance to respond to the disease. So, yes, I think it has worked. We can talk about if it's going to work in this situation, but I think it has worked before, yes.
Mr. Cornicelli, I've got a couple questions to follow up on that. 11 are a lot. 11 seems to be a lot of tests. There seems to be a lot of positives. You said there was one male included there. Can you give me the sexes and the ages of the deer that were tested or that were found positive?
Mr. Chair, we've had 35, now the slide's going to say 34, but it's 35 as of yesterday. We had another found dead deer. But of the 35 deer, most of them have been males, not all. I don't have the number off the top of my head. All of the animals that we see radiating out from our core have been males. The average age, they're adults. We've had, I think, 3-year-and-a-half-old deer that have tested positive, which means that they were probably exposed as fawns. But to date, most of our positives have been male, and most of those have been adults.
Yeah, and those are adult males, ranging adult males. What's the age range on adult male?
For our purposes, 2.5+. Not all of our teeth are back. We collect, in our CWD management zone, we collect a muscle sample and a tooth from every deer. So if it comes back positive, we can look at the genetic work to see if that animal was related to another positive deer, and then we send the teeth out for exact aging. I don't have the exact ages of all the animals, but suffice to say they're mostly adults, at 2.5 or older.
Senator Howe, do you have a question? I'm sorry. Okay. Anybody else so far? Okay,
continuing.
Proceed,
please. So in 2017, and I'm sure Dr. Thompson will talk about this, that there was a CWD-positive deer facility in Crow Wing County there was a trace out to a Meeker County farm. We instituted our CWD management plan and response plan and did surveillance around those facilities. We cast a wider net in those areas because of the fact that we hadn't done really any real big surveillance since the mid-2000s. So we looked at it as an opportunity to obviously do our risk-based surveillance, but also look around in a broader area within the permit area. So I'll get to what we did. And then in December 2017, the Winona County farm was positive, and since that was already wrapped up in our surveillance around Fillmore County, we're continuing to do that and amplifying some of our efforts. As you all know, we implemented a feeding ban. One of our goals is to reduce the human-caused or human-mediated interactions among deer. So we banned feeding, so you don't have deer congregating over a common food source. In 2016, for a long time, we followed the board's lead on banning carcasses with respect to importation. The statute says that cannot import carcasses. I may not get this perfectly correct, but you cannot import carcasses from areas that are known endemic areas as identified in the Board of Animal Health. Given the map is changing so quickly, we had a very difficult time keeping up with what was legal, what wasn't legal. So we banned all carcasses in 2016 from any other state. We're not alone in that regard. It's 12-plus states have now done that. So we've kind of followed and led a little bit with carcass import restrictions. This year we either mailed or emailed over 30,000 letters to Minnesota residents hunting in 10 states and at least one Canadian province to make them acutely aware of our restrictions. And this is the third year we've been sending letters to taxidermists and meat processors about our import restrictions. So we've been doing outreach to our hunters and our taxidermists and the processors who are regulated by the Department of Agriculture on our import restrictions. So we're trying to really get the word out about not adding to the risk that's out there.
Mr. Cornicelli, I'm not sure where the question should go, either you or Mr. Meyer, but during this period of importation, of making it illegal to import live animals, or I guess unprocessed meat to the state of Minnesota, has there been any arrests made at all by the DNR?
Mr. Chairman, if it'd be all right, I'd like to bring up Colonel Rodman Smith just to address some of our enforcement activities.
Sure. Send her.
Yeah, before
go ahead.
Yeah, before the officer come up, I just want to know how do you apply the test on the 4,000 deer and found out 11? How do you go about selecting those?
Maybe somebody wants to take us through the process of the testing and what has to happen and what has to be mailed off and what the turnaround time is.
I can do that. You want Colonel Smith to go first? Or?
Sure. Go ahead. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself.
Colonel Rodman Smith, Director of Enforcement, Department of Natural Resources. Mr. Chair, members, in the last few years, we've averaged a couple dozen citations for people that have been importing deer from out of state. We've been trying to go with that with the first couple years with that educational piece of, reminding people that it is illegal. This year, it is difficult. We're not sitting on I-94 over in Hudson Bridge waiting and looking at every vehicle that comes across the bridge. We decided to focus our efforts a little bit differently this year, since this was the third year that taxidermists and meat processors did get letters from Fish and Wildlife telling that it was illegal to accept imported carcasses from out of state. We did focus a little bit more on the commercial aspect of it, and we do have a number of things, open investigations from this fall that I don't want to comment on in front of the committee right now because they are ongoing investigations. But we have seen some fairly good compliance through some of our surveillance and some of our research and some of our investigations this year with some of those commercial processors. But we've also found some pretty disturbing issues as well that we're right in the middle of addressing.
So what you're doing is you're following up and doing an investigation with regards to the ones that transport them across the line as well as the ones where they end up, which would be the processors. So are you saying then that some of the processors are being looked at? I guess I know you can't certainly tell us that, but I mean you're certainly looking at that and monitoring that as well, because they're probably the ones that are reporting most of those to you. Is that correct? Them and maybe taxidermists.
Mr. Chair, members, you are correct. We have processors and taxidermists that are giving us information because they are following the letter of the law, and then we have others like any industry or any probably commercial enterprise that needs a little bit more attention. And so we're working We're working with all parties, good and bad.
I like the little more intention thing. Any other questions of the chief? Senator Hearn? Okay, you were going to answer that question.
Yep. Go ahead, Mr. Chair, Senator Howell. Basically, we've been doing deer tech stations for a long time in the state. Registration's been mandatory for over 100 years. We've been doing surveillance since 2002 and a lot in the southeast, so folks really know what we're doing. Basically, the deer comes in. We use DNR employees and also college students from University of Minnesota, Mankato, Central Lakes College, all over the place. So we train to take samples. We collect the sample, collect the data we need to line up with the sample. It goes. The samples go through a very rigorous data checking process. Worst thing we could do, finding the disease is bad. Finding the disease and not knowing where it was is worse. So we go through a lot of data checks. The samples go to Colorado State University, where they have a three to four day business day turnaround on our samples. They get screened with a test called an ELISA. If they come back as presumptive positive, they go through immunohistochemistry, and Colorado State is able to do both of those tests. So we get one-stop, relatively quick shopping.
So how did the deer come in? Through hunters or, you know, professional hobbyists?
Mr. Chair, Senator, hunters. The vast majority of our surveillance is hunter-harvested, right? We do a lot of outreach that we're working these stations. The surveillance is mandatory. You know, bring your deer in, put the head towards the back of the tailgate, and it's the hunters who do that. And our compliance is really quite excellent in this state.
And before Senator Bingham, tell me what you do with the carcass until you find out whether it's positive or negative.
Mr. Chair, it depends on where you are. If you're outside the CWD management zone, there are no carcass restrictions. We ask people to responsibly handle their carcass. If it's in the zone, the carcass has to stay in the zone until a not detected test is reported 3 or 4 days later. We have a refrigerated trailer in Preston for hunters who don't have a place to store deer, and we'll hold them until the test comes back. We have a Share the Harvest program with Bluffalo Whitetails to give deer out to folks who want them. But when we get a CWD positive deer, we attempt to retrieve the carcass. And the carcass and the meat, we take to the University of Minnesota with their alkaline digester. So we have the remains digested, which is an acceptable form of disposal. So we do our best to get the carcass off the landscape and get the meat into the digester. And we also have a dumpster in Preston, and those remains go to a lined landfill. So we have a quartering shed, a dumpster, and a refrigerated trailer in Preston that really try to provide that one-stop shopping for our hunters. And all three of those get heavy use, so they've worked out really well.
Senator Bingham.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple weeks ago during the special hunt, I had the opportunity to go down to Preston and see the sampling station, and I just can't say enough good things about the process, the professionalism, and the excitement of the hunters, of course, that we're bringing in the deer. But it was just a methodical process with oversight from each other and peer review of everything. And I just was so impressed by the process from the students at the university to the DNR staff and other local authorities that were stopping by. It was just quite the experience to see, and I encourage folks, if there are other special hunts, to stop by one of the sampling stations, because it was impressive, and thank you to your staff for organizing that.
Mr. Chair, Senator Bingham, thank you very much. I will relay that to my staff. They would appreciate those kind words. Thank you.
And you can proceed, Mr. Cornicelli, and I'm assuming that you're going to, I'm sorry, Senator Senjum first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Carnicelli, I'm sitting here thinking about, and I want you just to relate to, I know you don't know the answer to this question, we're going to ask anyway. So is it possible that CWD has been endemic in deer for 10 years, 100 years, 1,000 years, and we just didn't recognize it until ELISA and immunohistochemistry came along and so on and so forth? Is that even a reasonable thought?
Mr. Cornicelli.
Mr. Chair, Senator Senjum, thanks for noting that I probably can't answer that question. It's a very difficult question to answer, but the science would suggest that probably not. Some of the testing, the techniques are always evolving and getting better. However, none of the states have ever seen this before, and we haven't seen, if the disease had existed for a really long time, we would look a lot different than we look right now. And given the prevalence increases in Wisconsin and the numbers of animals that they're finding that are in the process of dying or are dead, would indicate that the disease is relatively new.
Okay. And deer have always died, but there must be. You're suggesting that either the postmortem, whatever you do on occasional deer, even 50 years ago, this is different than that. Is that kind of what you're saying?
Mr. Chair, Senator Sengem, yes, I think it is. The disease was first described in 1967. It was recognized as a TSE in the mid-1970s. I can't remember the year. However, the fact that we've not seen animals behaving this way in the past would indicate that it is relatively recent. I get where you're coming from, because nothing in science is a proof, right? It's all inferences based on the knowledge that you gain over the years. But it does not indicate that this disease has been existing for any longer than what's been described.
Okay, members, we have a fair amount of time left for the presentation. Then we want to get to the Board of Animal Health. So let's hold our questions till the end, and we'll move through it.
Mr. Chair, I can talk as fast as you want.
I know.
So 2017, 2018, doing as a response to our risk-based surveillance, we did surveillance around the two captive servant facilities. In the Crow Wing County area, over the last 2 years, we've collected almost 8,700 deer. If you look at the map, you can see the black dots and the blue dots. Those are two different years. In Meeker County, we're in year two of our surveillance. We've collected almost 3,000 samples. Deer populations in that part of the state aren't nearly as high as they are in Crow Wing County. So the sample sizes are a function of what hunters are harvesting. Our compliance has been very high, to speak to Senator Howe's point. Our calculated compliance is over 90%. Most people are having their deer tested over opening weekend. Normally, we do 3 years of surveillance. However, the Crow Wing County farm still has deer, and they still have positive deer, so we're going to likely be doing surveillance around that facility until such time as it's been depopulated and we go 3 years out. Because as long as there are deer on that farm, as long as deer are testing positive, obviously, it's still risk. So we have to keep doing surveillance. If we do one more year in Meeker County and find nothing, then we'll call it good there. In the southeast, since 2016, we've done over 12,000 deer. Our brief history is we found the wild deer in Fillmore County in 16 that I talked about. There's the captive deer in Winona County in 2017, and then just this past deer season, late November, in Houston County. So total samples, to kind of put it all on a map, we've done 24,000 deer in the last 3 years. We've had 30, that slide is, as of last night, inaccurate. It's 35 positives. We had another found dead buck in Preston. And if you can look at the map, most of those deer are clustered around Preston, except for the animals that are spoked out around, and those are all males. And then the one deer in Houston County, in the north of Houston. So what are we doing statewide in the southeast? We're going to continue our mandatory surveillance. We have carcass export restrictions in our disease area our compliance is excellent with our carcass export restrictions, and I can explain why if you need me to. As I said before, we have a quartering station, a refrigerated trailer, and a dumpster in Preston that get a lot of use. We had two late-season special hunts in Fillmore County and around, and we killed 651 deer, had three more positives in the zone. We had an abbreviated time between when we wanted to do postseason culling and the end of our last special hunt, so we made the decision to mail permits to every landowner with 20 acres or more. We mailed out 3,500 permits. As of last night, I got another update after I sent this presentation off. They took around 350 deer. So we killed a few deer with the landowner permits. We're partnering with Buffalo and Whitetails on a Share the Harvest program, which has been very popular. USDA culling is in part on hold because of the federal shutdown. Our principal person who gets permission is furloughed. In addition, the weather hasn't been great either. So we've delayed it a little bit for a couple of reasons. We do a lot of human dimensions work in this agency. We're surveying both hunters and landowners in the southeast to talk about risk perceptions, attitudes towards our disease response, behavioral changes, different regulatory options, different incentive options. So we're really quantitatively looking at how our hunters and landowners feel about this disease, our response to this disease, and what options we might have. We're in the process of updating our CWD response plan. We're adding a section on basically living with CWD, setting up control zones, looking at incentives, all a host of different options. And once we get some of our social science data back, we're going to be looking at releasing, doing some sort of a public input process, public involvement process, to inform folks about the plan and look at different options. So we're really approaching this from as many directions as we can, both from the deer side and the human side. An interesting tidbit of information is, as you would expect, you know, deer use rivers and streams. So our positives are really showing up in riparian corridors. Those animals, the females are serving as anchors. In other words, that's our node of disease. And those males are spreading it across the landscape, really through those riparian corridors. And if you're a deer hunter, you know they like to move to those habitats. So to address some of our expenditures, this work is really expensive, as you can well imagine. Since 2002, we've spent almost $8.5 million on our CWD work. $7.2 million of that has come from the Game and Fish Fund. Over the last 5 years of surveillance, it's been entirely out of the Game and Fish Fund. So we're doing this response around captive facilities in the wild for the health of deer across the state, and it's really being borne on the backs of folks who buy licenses. Hunter numbers, the no data are entirely conclusive. Senator Senjman, I talked about proof versus inference. We know that we're losing deer hunters naturally with aging of deer hunters. This is not unique to Minnesota. However, we're losing them at higher rates in the southeast over the last 2 years. We've lost about 10% of our deer hunters in the southeast as a whole, and almost 12%, specifically around our disease management area. So this has an implication to deer hunters as well. Even though there hasn't been documented human health risks, the perceptions of disease, I think, is causing people to take a pause on going deer hunting. And Wisconsin has seen the same thing with declines in hunter numbers. So we are losing hunters in the southeast and around our disease rate at higher levels than we're losing statewide. Why is that important? You know, as Senator Ingebrigtsen said, we have 500,000 deer hunters. We're just under that now. The last survey that was done, about $500 million to the state's economy. Our response this year will cost about $1.3 million, not including the work that law enforcement does related to this disease. So it's really expensive. We spend about this is an average, it's not an absolute, about $150,000 a year around captive server facilities that are positive. And again, we do that over a 3-year period, but we'll continue to do it in Crow Wing County. Those long-term economic losses, you know, they do exceed short-term surveillance and management. You know, the losing 15,000 deer hunters costs a lot more than spent $1 million in surveillance. And so the money we spend up front may benefit us in the long term. And like I said, likely losing hunters because of risk perception. We'll be evaluating that with our human dimension surveys. But the numbers, you can't explain the numbers, and it really, with the absence of other data. So in addition to surveillance, we're looking at how deer move on the landscape. We have an LCCMR project, partially funded project, looking at deer movements. We captured deer around and in our CWD zone last year, looking at dispersal. What's the capability of a deer to move a prion infected animal from one place to another? So over a 3-year period, we'll be collaring deer, young deer in the area to look at movement and also cause-specific mortality for our population model. These deer move a long way, as you can well imagine. Our longest trek was a female who went 77 miles, but they do move a long way. What we found that's really interesting is, you know, we always hear, I put in a food plot, you know, these are my deer. I want to keep my deer on the property. You know, what are you doing to my deer? And even a first year of data shows that these are everybody's deer. They're not just your deer. Here's one male that we caught southwest of Houston in March. Look at where he went. He set up a new home range in the fall, several miles to the south. This one male moved about 6 miles in one direction. He's been on 82 separate parcels, so just one deer on 82 different landowners over the course of a six-month period. So we look at this as these are a shared responsibility. These are everybody's deer. And then the concern about an animal having the ability to take that disease and move it by itself over long distances and knowing where those animals should be. One of our challenges, public versus private land. If you look at this map, there's a lot of white. That's our CWD management zone. That white's private land. The little bit of public land or state forest and Forestville State Park and a couple of SNAs. Most of our response is on private land in this area, which makes it challenging. Land access is an issue, mostly on private land. Also did some difficulties on county and city properties, and we're trying to work through those. As scientists, we have a difficulty explaining science versus emotions, right? We're very good at talking about data, talking about statistical significance and prevalence. We're good at that. But we have a really difficult time explaining the long-term implications of this disease on deer populations because it's something that you can't see today. We're not having those droolers and shakers that Wisconsin is describing. So we have a hard time explaining things that you can't see right now. Funding, response is expensive, like I talked about. I think, and to speak to Senator Tomasoni said, we have a narrow window to be successful, and that window may have closed in the Preston area for eliminating the disease. We don't know yet. We do know that the longer it exists, the less likely we are to eliminate it. And finally, to close, deer move all over the landscape, so how big should our zone be? Because every time the zone gets bigger, it affects more people. So that's a question that we have to answer as the management agency. And Mr. Chair, Representative, or Senators, that's all I had for this morning.
Thank you. Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think you answered my question in one of your concluding statements, one of your wrap-up statements. Mr. Cornicelli, is our policy goal to eliminate CWD in Minnesota? Is that what we're trying to achieve? Is that possible? And if it's not possible, you said something about the window closing. Do we have a metric that shows the tipping point beyond which we just simply need to engage in managing and minimizing CWD on the landscape?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dibble, that's an excellent question, and that's one that we're facing right now. I think when you find the disease early, you have an aggressive response, you have the opportunity to eliminate it, like I spoke about. The fact that we're starting to see males moving on the landscape further away makes us think that we may not be able to eliminate it in the Preston area. We're going to keep trying, and this fall's this winter's activities will always give us more information, and that's kind of the reason for redoing our plan, because I think we may have to start thinking about what are we going to do if we have to live with the disease. That means having a disease zone and a control area. How do we manage deer differently in both of those areas? Not giving up the ghost, obviously, in our disease area, but doing what we can to limit spread to other parts of the state. Our number one goal, obviously, is eliminating disease. And that doesn't mean eliminating the deer. I mean, we hear a lot about that. That's not what we're talking about. But if we're stuck living with the disease and we want to do what we can to minimize it, both in that area and also out of that area. It's a very difficult question to answer.
Senator Bingham.
Thank you. Because this isn't caused by a bacteria virus, there would be no vaccine or no way like that to stop the disease. Right? I've heard a couple people mention that, and I just wanted to ask.
Mr. Chair, Senator Bingham, that's correct. There is no vaccine or reliable antimortem test. There's no... there isn't at this point in time.
Go ahead, Senator Eden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, my question has to do with the study in Canada where the primates contracted the disease from eating contaminated meat. Due to that, is there any thoughts of requiring testing of all deer that are taken before consumption?
Mr. Cornicelli.
Mr. Chair, Senator Eaton. Yes, the Canadian study, I think it's safe to say all of us are waiting for the results of that study. It's not through peer review yet. I think it's still ongoing. So, and I think that's why the preliminary results of that study is why you saw the CDC guidelines change a little bit. It would be difficult for a state wildlife agency to test every deer that's harvested. Our deer plan calls for an average harvest of 200,000 deer a year. I don't think we'd be able to do that. And in addition, it's not a food safety test. It's a detected, not detected test. So as a state wildlife agency, it would be very difficult for us to test every deer that's harvested. It would certainly, the cost of testing would certainly exceed the cost of a license for us. So it would be a monumental effort to do that. And again, if there becomes a food safety issue, then I think the landscape changes pretty immediately.
Okay, one more question, Mr. Senator Howe. We're going to move on then to the Board of Animal Health.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. The question I have is there any commonality to environmental factors where these diseased deer are, or is it just the environment has no common factors where we find these deer?
Cornicelli.
Mr. Chair, Senator Howe, no, there aren't any environmental commonalities related to where the disease is found.
Okay. Bob, anything else? Bob.
Mr. Chairman, members, Madam Chair, thank you so much for spending the important time talking about this important issue with us. I do have one final handout for the committee, if I could get the page to distribute it for me. The question that we get all the time is, what's not getting done because of us having to spend these dollars? And first, I need to thank you all for your support last session for some partial funding that would have provided our testing results. It was $750,000 that unfortunately never made it to final passage. But we are hopeful that we can gain support with you on these issues in the coming session. And the handout that's going around just outlines the activities that we weren't able to do because of, as Dr. Cornicelli said, the $1.3 million we had to spend out of the Game and Fish Fund. We've spent to date over 11,000 hours of FTEs, 11,000 man hours, trying to work on this issue. And this handout, rather than to go into it with the time considerations, is just something for you to have and put in your files that shows the impact of the Game and Fish Fund from this work we had to do.
Thank you for the presentation. And members, if you have any questions of these gentlemen, please certainly feel free to give them a call. Have them come to your office. I still have a bunch of questions that I want answered that I think are going to be important here. But we should be taking this very seriously. And again, thank you very much for the presentation.
Thank you.
Next, we'll call on the Board of Animal Health, Beth Thompson. Thompson, you have someone with you, I see.
Mr. Chair, Linda Glazer is with me. She is the program director. She's my lifeline in case any questions get too difficult.
Welcome.
Thank you. Hopefully I can run the slideshow by myself.
Well, I know who can't help you with that. That's me. Again, welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and go ahead with your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, Beth Thompson. I am the Executive Director of the Minnesota Board of Animal Health and also the state veterinarian. I appreciate the fact that you all wanted to listen to what we do at the Board of Animal Health for the Farm Survey Day program. I also appreciate the fact that you had Dr. Cornicelli go first, so he covered a lot of that background information, that scientific information about chronic wasting disease and this very devastating disease, both for farm cervid and the wild cervids in the state of Minnesota. Just a little bit of background, the Board of Animal Health is actually a board. We have 5 board members that are appointed by the governor. We have 3 producers and 2 veterinarians that sit on our board. Our staff right now sits at 44 employees. That staff is divided amongst the board office in St. Paul, our field staff, and then also the Minnesota Poultry Testing Laboratory. And I'll get into a little bit more detail of what our staff requirements are for this program, in addition to some of the help that we get from the United States Department of Agriculture, or USDA. But first of all, as far as the program background, Minnesota state law that pulled the program into the board's purview happened in January of 2004, and farm cervidae are considered livestock, and of course that includes deer, elk, and a number of different species within that family. I hope you all got a handout that is two-sided and looks like this. The information that is on the screen right now regarding the different species, herds, number of animals, and average herd size is on that handout. This is at the end of state fiscal year 2018. There were 8,006 head of animals, farm cervids, within the state of Minnesota. Showing on your handout right below that is the number of farm cervids from the previous state fiscal year, or 10,607 head of farm cervids within the state of Minnesota, meaning that there was a decrease between state fiscal year 17 and 18 of approximately 2,600 animals. This is also a handout, I believe, that was provided to you. This is the location of the farm cervidae herds across the state of Minnesota. And the blue area outlined down in the bottom right-hand corner of that is the CWD endemic area that is established by the Board of Animal Health based on what's being found in farm cervidae. I tried to go through and count up the number of counties that do not have farm cervids across the state of Minnesota. There's a handful, maybe 10. But we can get more direct information if you all want that information about the counties that do not have farm cervids, but the vast majority of our counties do have farm cervids on the ground. The regulations for this program are found in the board's chapter. That would be chapter 35, and then also the accompanying rules, which is 1721. For the most part, that list on the left-hand side of the screen are farm cervidae owner requirements. They need to register with the board. They need to do certain things if there is a farm cervid that escapes, and I will cover that again in another slide. They need to report if there are wild cervids within their enclosure. Fencing must be at 96 inches, at least 96 inches. Animals must be identified. They must carry out CWD surveillance, and there's also paperwork and a process that they need to go through if they're importing into the state any farm cervids. Overall, and I had these numbers pulled, I apologize, I don't have it on the screen here. Since July 1st of 2018, there have been 84 total compliance activities related to these requirements of the program. 32 of those were inspection-related compliance activities, 9 of those being fencing, and an additional 52 compliance activities related to inventories or the non-payment of fees. So again, I apologize for not having that information on the screen for you, but those are the numbers that were pulled earlier this morning.
Ms. Thompson, can I have you to back up quickly to the first one? On the very top of the page, you have species, herds, animals, average herd size, and then certified herds. Can you describe the difference there on the certified herds?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, yes. CWD certified herds, they have to go through a process of so much surveillance prior to being certified for CWD. That's what that number includes. So the certified herd, 58 of the 87 elk herds are certified, meaning that they've gone through significant surveillance, ongoing surveillance for chronic wasting disease. That also allows them, depending on the state, and I think most states require that certification prior to any of the animals from Minnesota moving into another state. Likewise, we would require that of animals moving from another state into the state of Minnesota.
Is there a cost to that, to the producer? A special cost to be certified like that or not?
There isn't a separate fee. Mr. Chair, there is not a separate fee for that, no.
Okay. All right, thank you.
The staffing for this program, of course, we've got Dr. Glazer and a senior veterinarian in the St. Paul office that oversee this program in addition to two additional office staff. Field staff, and you guys will have to stay with me on this one, our state field staff, there are seven veterinarians and five compliance officers, all of which have some part of this program, meaning they go out and help inspect or work with those 380-some herds. We also, in the state of Minnesota, utilize USDA, United States Department of Agriculture staff. Those staff are here. I mean, we use those staff for a variety of different reasons, mainly emergency response, but they are also available to us for this program. Unfortunately, they're on furlough right now, so I don't have exact numbers for fiscal year 18, but as reported for state fiscal year 17, USDA field staff put in 2,700 hours on this program. Board expenditures for state fiscal year 17 were $548,000. They went up in state fiscal year 18 to $674,000, almost $675,000. Inspection components. And this is what our field staff or USDA field staff do when they go out to visit these herd owners. Again, a lot of the onus is on the herd owner, herd manager. When talking to our field staff, some of our field staff will take the inventory from the prior year out and compare it to the inventory that the owner has, or it may be a verbal communication over the telephone before they go out, but an inventory is done. This is somewhat unique to, or very unique to our CERVID program. Inventories aren't required for other agricultural, the other livestock, so we don't do inventories on cattle herds or hog herds. There's also a check on the fencing. The field staff will also look at the record keeping. Is the owner keeping records for 10 years, and do those records include movement reports, death reports, any of the CWD testing that's been done? And in addition to that, there's the looking at the, going back to the official identification, making sure that we can see the official identification that's required in those animals. Escapes, Chapter 35, there's a couple of different provisions within that chapter that talks about escapes. First of all, an owner, a farm survey owner, may not allow the animals to run at large. And if they are running at large, DNR must become involved. We've worked out a plan and procedure with DNR because, generally speaking, we will get the call first rather than DNR, or it's reported by a member of the public. So we have a policy and procedure in place to work with DNR on those escapes. And then if the owner is unwilling or unable to bring those cervids back into the fence, the DNR may destroy those animals. Again, referring to the piece of paper that two-sided, this is on the back side of your piece of paper. There's more information than what's up on the screen, but the state fiscal year 2018 escape data is there. And then at the very bottom of that page, we looked at the CWD testing that was also done on those escapes. So overall, for state fiscal year 18, there was a total of 54 animals that escaped. The reasons for those escapes are listed on the right-hand side of that sheet of paper. 22 were returned, 28 were killed, and we had 4 lost animals. And again, the variety of different reasons how these animals get outside the fence, including gates being left open or damage to fences or things such as that going on. So there are escapes that happen, but the board and the DNR work together on those escapes to either dispatch the animal or get the animal back into the fence.
Ms. Thompson, are they identifiable? And tell me how.
Mr. Chair, the animals that escape, mm-hmm. they should have official ID in them, in their ear.
Okay. In tag?
That was part of the inspection procedures, sure. too.
Just so people know that. Yep. Thank you.
Moving on to mandatory CWD surveillance, there is 100% surveillance that's required by the law. All farm cervids that die or are slaughtered must be surveilled for chronic wasting disease. And again, as Dr. Cornicelli pointed out, chronic wasting disease testing can only be done at this point in time on a dead animal. Samples can be taken by the producer, the owner, veterinarian, regulatory staff, or the whole head can be sent into the veterinary diagnostic lab. There's an extra fee that's involved with that, but that can also be an avenue for our producers to get animals tested. If eligible animals aren't tested, and the surveillance period is advanced. In other words, if I have a farm survey farm, and I have my anniversary date is January 1st of 2016, if I miss a test, my anniversary date is advanced, meaning that it becomes possibly June of 2016, depending how much other testing that I've done in the past. So that anniversary date is affected if producers do not submit good tests. And in addition to that, as the slide states, if there's a disregard for sampling, if we've got somebody that isn't doing sampling on an ongoing basis, the whole herd status for that herd can be dropped. In 2019 also, we are going to put into place a training program for producers, veterinarians, anybody that wants to get involved and get trained in on taking CWD samples. If you don't do this on an ongoing basis, it's good to have the training, and hopefully this is a training that we can continue to have throughout the years so producers and veterinarians have that background.
Let me ask you this, Ms. Thompson. So you have these requirements of the Cervidae farms, and if they don't comply, so if you have somebody that has had a couple of incidents where the animals were tested and you weren't notified, how would you know that you aren't notified? I mean, how do you finish up that circle there? I mean, how do you know that? And what authority do you have if you have a and I'll go out on the limb and say, like any other business, you're going to have somebody who's a bad producer or a bad player, consistently bad. What authority do you have at that point in time if you have something like that going on?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, first of all, to the first part of that question, if an animal isn't tested and dies, let's back that up, it dies and then isn't tested, that would show up on an inventory. That would be a hole on that inventory that's done on a year-by-year basis. So that would be the starting point for that that investigation. Now, if we have that producer that isn't reporting testing, isn't doing their inventory, the board does have the ability to pull the registration. And that authority is located in Chapter 35. Unfortunately, the question then becomes, what do you do with the animals? If the person is not registered, which they need to be by law in the state of Minnesota, that would be a cooperative effort with the Department of Natural Resources, because those animals then become not farmed cervids. We have not gotten to that point. We did have a case some years ago where there was a gentleman that had cervids, and there were major issues with that, but he eventually sold the cervids and got out of the business. So it's a long way around, Mr. Sure. Chair, to answer your question.
Yeah, but it certainly sounds like they're quite regulated, and it's just, I guess, the question I'm sure other people may ask here before the day's end is, are you staffed enough to properly do the inspections? So go ahead, keep going. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, one of the requests from the Board of Animal Health was a map showing the infected farm cervid herds in the state of Minnesota, which I have up on the screen right now. Dr. Cornicelli did mention the Aiken herd back in 2002. And this may help you more. Oh, and maybe I didn't put it in here. I do have a timeline, if anybody is interested in an ongoing timeline of the cervid herds rather than up on a map like this. But starting with Aiken in 2002, we also have, as folks from DNR mentioned, the Crow Wing County herd in 2016. We also and the last herd that we found infected was in Winona in 2017. That herd's already been depopulated. The Crow Wing herd, sitting up there in the middle of the state in 2016, that herd found positives in 2016. They opted not to depopulate. That is a process that you need to go through with the United States Department of Agriculture for indemnity. The herd was standing. In 2017, there were no positive samples from that herd. Unfortunately, now in 2018, there were positive samples, and the herd owner, my understanding, is now electing to depopulate that herd. There is an indemnity process that we need to go through with USDA, and again, once because of the shutdown, that process has come to a halt, but as soon as the federal folks are back at work, we're going to continue, and that herd should be depopulated.
Madam Chair.
So if the herd is depopulated, can that farm then repopulate in the same area, or are they just out of business then, or what happens after they depopulate?
Ms. Dobson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. What happens in those situations is because there is indemnity paid by USDA, there is a herd plan that's entered into between USDA, the herd owner, and the Board of Animal Health. In the past, there has been, as part of that agreement, no farm servants could be allowed on that land for a period of 5 years, and fencing needs to stay in place so that it decreases or eliminates the risk of any wild servants getting on that farm too. So in the past, I can tell you that 5 years has been the time that no servant aid whatsoever are allowed on that site.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Tomasoni.
So give me a little bit better idea of numbers. So go back one slide. And you've got, so the crow wing, you had in 2016, there were some sick deer. In 2017, there weren't any. In 2018, there were some. Tell me how that works, and how many deer did you actually identify as having a problem? So in 2016, you had what, two deer out of how many, or what was the number?
Yes, and Mr. Chair, Senator, it's also included on the information on your sheet, but the farm had 106 animals on the site as of December 28th of 2018, first identified in 2016 when two white-tailed deer tested positive. The herd was quarantined at that point in time in 2017. 62 animals were harvested, and there was no CWD detected. In 2018, 32 animals have been harvested and tested for CWD. Of those 32 animals, 7 have now tested positive. Senator, I believe those are the numbers.
That's what I was looking for. So so the farm itself had 106 animals. In December of 20, how many animals total did they have from 16 to 18? I'm assuming they breed and then they grow and all that stuff happens, but they've harvested quite a few animals, and I'm just trying to figure out what goes on these farms and then how they determine to get rid of them all.
Ms. Thompson.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I'm going to turn it over to my lifeline, Dr. Glazer.
Mr. Chair and Senator, herd originally
I'm
had...
Sorry, for the record, please, your name.
Oh,
please.
My name is Linda Glazer.
Thank
I'm
you.
The program leader for the Farm Servant Program.
Thank you.
The herd had, I don't have the exact numbers, but it had originally about 130 animals when it was first diagnosed, found positive with the two CWD-infected deer. This owner has a combination of a breeding operation as well as a hunt operation. So they do hunt some of the animals within an enclosure on this property. And so last year the focus was reducing the inventory in his herd for whatever reasons he had through hunting these animals. And so 62 of them were harvested in that manner for testing. And then again, he minimized the breeding operation as well. So his population in his herd is reducing for intentional reasons of his management. And then this year again, they harvested more animals and did the testing, the 30 animals. So, and now the population stands at about 100. And actually, this herd has a combination of two species of deer, both whitetail and mule deer. And he manages those a little differently for whatever his reasons are.
Okay. Follow up. Any other questions so far? Has there, in fairness, has there been a any evidence or maybe you have an opinion that a there's been a wild transmission into a captive situation? In other words, a CWD wild animal, wild whitetail, were to pass that disease on to somebody in a farm setting. You had anything like that? And I understand that's why the DNR does the random testing around those areas, but have you any indication at all of that?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, specifically a live wild animal transmitting to a farm survey herd, I am not aware of any of that in the state of Minnesota. Certainly we have concerns when, as Mr. Cornicelli pointed out, the environmental contamination, whether or not, I know the state veterinarian from Wisconsin would tell you that it's possible for CWD to be moved by plants with dirt attached, you know, mm-hmm. things along those lines. But back to your question, Mr. Chair, specifically a wild animal to a farmed animal, no, I am not aware.
And I was remiss in asking the question of the DNR. Do they have a growing operation themselves? Do they raise cervidae? I don't know that they have. I've never been told that. Do you know?
Mr. Chair, DNR?
DNR.
I'm not aware of that, no.
Okay.
No.
All right. Okay.
Just a couple more slides. Mm-hmm. As mentioned, we do have an endemic area. It was on the larger map with all the herds that's located down in the southeastern part of the state based on the wild CWD population down, or information that we're getting from the DNR down in that area. Because of that endemic area, that does affect farmed sites within that area. They are not allowed to move any animals. It's a movement restriction that goes on those farms in the endemic area unless they are to build a fence, a double fence around their farm, so that we can rest assured that there is no transmission between the wild and the farm cervids in those areas. In addition to that, the same type of endemic area, the same type of idea also applies to imports that are coming into the state of Minnesota. And we look to, and again, you've seen this map before, we look to what's going on in other states and how it's reported out. In addition to the couple of states that Mr. Cornicelli mentioned, I noticed yesterday, and maybe it is on this map too, but Iowa has had some additional wild CWD positives. That far northeastern county in Iowa that is positive, endemic for CWD, it now appears that they've gotten some additionals south of that in, I can't remember the name of the counties now, a couple of counties just below that, and then further south down in Dubuque County too. So we continually look at that for determining whether or not farm cervids can be imported into the state. In addition to that, looking at that, I've also broken down, or again, back on that front page of that handout that we gave to you, we do give you the information for the fiscal year 18 cervid imports. There were 113 animals that were imported into the state of Minnesota, and we broke those out by shipments. So it's not 113 separate shipments of animals, but 113 total animals coming in via shipments. And that, Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, if there are any additional questions.
Members, any questions? I have a lot of questions, but we only have so much time. And again, I think we all should be looking at this very seriously. I keep referring to Wisconsin. We don't want to be Wisconsin and in the same position they're in with their whitetail population. Maybe you can answer this. I know 3 years ago, and I don't know if the committee all knows this, but we had a test zone, if you will, or a pilot project in southeastern Minnesota in this area, I believe, excuse me, a four-point restriction. And the discussion, maybe some of you are getting some emails, with regards to the four-point restriction, I'm getting some from other parts of the state. Please don't let that happen in my area because, the whole social change of taking big deer and only big deer is, I think at one time it was quite exciting, and it's and quality deer management is something that's real big in some parts of the state. But what I'm hearing about these bucks that are actually transmitting the disease, it seems like the most of them are males moving around, ranging around. Do you think that four-point restriction thing is a good idea? That really gets into a pretty hard question to answer, probably, especially with the social change of everybody having to have a monster hanging on the wall, and that's all we're going to shoot. We're not going to shoot the smaller ones. Any ideas, any views on that at all, by leaving the big bucks run?
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, members of the committee, the last time I went hunting was 2013, and it wasn't a big buck. It was a smaller one.
I have that experience quite often myself.
Yeah. I would push that question to the experts at the Department of Natural Resources as far as what their thoughts are on that. And you know, I realize constituents are concerned, but I can tell you and assure you that both the Department of Natural Resources and the Board of Animal Health take this disease very seriously. And we have had successes in the past working together, whether it would be bovine tuberculosis or the ongoing work that we do to keep feral swine out of this state. It's very important, and I think, and again, I'd push that question back to the experts at the Department of Natural Resources, but I think working together and having the smart people at the table is what we need to do.
Real good. Glad to hear that. And you do get together with the DNR, both your departments get together and have meetings quite often, is that fair to say? And I'm glad to hear you're certainly monitoring and very serious about the swine thing, for sure. I mean, we talked about that some years ago, and there's a reason why we don't want them here. But before we have Bob step up again, Mr. Meyer, would you come forward and answer that question about the four-point restriction, what your feeling is, and how the cooperation has been going between the two agencies?
Mr. Chairman, members, thank you. For the record, Bob Meyer, Assistant Commissioner, Department of Natural Resources. The antler point restriction is a tool that people wanted to have bigger bucks. Obviously, with this issue and this disease management, that is kind of out the window right now, and we need to look at how do we manage this population. And the information Dr. Cornicelli showed you about the movement of those deer, the young bucks, is very concerning, so we need to work with the constituents, Bluffland Whitetails Group, Minnesota Deer Hunters, and talk about the future of those antler point restrictions moving forward. As far as our work with the board, it's been great. We're actually in the process of finalizing and signing a new memorandum of understanding that clarifies how we will do business together. And it's been great, the refreshing conversations we've had, and I look forward to strengthening that relationship in the future. One other thing that I would like to bring to your attention is that tonight we're holding a public meeting in Winona from 7 to 8:30. To just talk about the importance of our chronic wasting disease management in Houston and in the Winona County area. That's from 7 to 8:30 at the Tau Center Rotunda at Winona State University. So we can provide you an update on that as well, members, as after that meeting's done. We held a public meeting in Preston here a week and a half ago or so.
Thanks. Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had a question about the... There was mention of the, and I heard on the news a few days ago as well, the delay in the culling that was going to be carried out by the USDA. I don't know if there are any details of that discussed before I made it into the room today. So how concerned are we about that delay in the planned culling by the USDA? And is it possible to proceed with it and then, you know, with state resources and personnel, and then maybe request being reimbursed later after the government has been reopened from the USDA, if that's even possible.
Mr. Mark.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dibble, thank you for that question, and I'll do the best answer. Maybe have to bring up Dr. Cornicelli. But so the funding of it, we were paying USDA for those services for the culling. The major problem we have is the person who was in charge of those contracts and getting that work scheduled is a furloughed. So the other work that's ongoing right now is working with the local units of government, Fillmore County, Lanesboro, to help them understand the importance of disease management and the culling of that herd so we can get access to their property. One of the hot spots that we were looking at in Preston was a veteran cemetery. We had discussions, and that is off the table due to the sacredness of the veteran cemetery with people being buried there. But we are looking to try to get access to property around, immediately surrounding that site, because that is a known hotspot for us. So we need to reach out and do more work with those private landowners and also the local units of government in the coming weeks. As far as the timing of it, the weather hasn't been the best. So the way that these activities are done is it's hunted over bait, or they're removed over bait to concentrate the animals. They haven't been moving into those sites as we wish to, so we continue to do our work and stage for the events, but the federal shutdown does have some impact on that.
Senator Simonson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question for Mr. Meyer before we wrap up here, but thank you for the presentation. Obviously, this is very good information, and clearly continues to be a serious problem here in Minnesota. But I'll only speak for myself, but I think we look to you as the agency for recommendations in terms of solutions. My question is, are we going to see a policy recommendation come forward from the department in terms of additional tools that we can put in place to help you move forward towards a solution? Or will there be something built into your budget request for the next biennium along those same lines?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, thank you for that important question. We are in the process of establishing Governor Walz's biennial budget. There is a proposal that is out there to help fund these activities for our CWD surveillance. And as Dr. Cornicelli mentioned, that is our first and foremost priority, is try to reduce those number of animals in the zone and to see if we are successful at that level. Hopefully we are, but it will take several years for that testing to go through. If not, we will need to have discussions with you all and our stakeholders, the citizens of the state of Minnesota, on, as Dr. Cornicelli said, what is the future of living with a CWD positive wild deer herd, and what does that mean in Minnesota?
One last question. Senator Dibble.
Sorry, thanks. Try not to delay us. So just a little bit more understanding about the disease and its transmission vectors and the like. We talked about making sure that a particular area stays free. Removing the carcasses is important, and that the area, for example, the farms remain free for 3 or 5 years. Do these prions persist in the environment? Are they spread by scavenger birds? What kind of practices do butchers and people preparing carcasses need to engage in terms of cleaning their equipment to make sure that these prions aren't being spread around? I mean, just some basic, if you have 60 seconds on that, I'm just curious.
Who'd like to take a stab at that?
Mr. Chair and Senator Dibble, I can try to take a stab at that. There, Dr. Cornicelli would also be, one of the more experts, and I have looked to experts, usually at U.S. Geological Survey, to answer some of these questions. But there is evidence that scavengers, can ingest tissues that are infected with CWD and serve as mechanical transmitters of that. In other words, it goes through their intestinal tract and is defecated out and is still active prion. We also know that carnivores, there's some evidence that carnivores may be able to do that as well. It can persist in the environment for a period of time. I believe there's also publications related to uptake of prions in plants. And so that's another area. It can last in soil, and there's certain types of soil that it lasts longer in. I think clay, my understanding is clay associated, that, but I'm not familiar with the more recent research on that. So once we put it into the environment, it can be there for a while, and then it can If it's scavenged by other species, it can pass through that animal. They also show that feral pigs have become infected with prions, CWD prions. They haven't seen, they didn't report, as I understand it, any clinical signs in them, but they did, you know, infect it. So what happens when that prion moves through another species? And, you know, typically they can change and modify in a bit and survive in new ways and shapes. So it's certainly the body of evidence with all the different types of prions diseases is pretty concerning.
And Mr. Chair, and equipment, is there a recommended way to disinfect equipment that's used to prepare, to clean and prepare carcasses and meat?
Mr. Chair and Senator, it takes pretty extreme measures to inactivate or destroy this prion. So standard disinfectant procedures for bacteria and viruses typically will not impact this. And, potentially they can use extreme measures that are not available to most processors or, let's say, veterinary clinics, so that disposing of the equipment used is, you know, probably the safest way to ensure that they're gone.
Okay. Senator Bingham, then we're...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's actually more of a comment. When I was down at the sampling station, there's no bleach or steam or anything like that that can take the, clean the machines that prepare the carcasses or, even the materials that were used, equipment that was used to take the nodes for sampling. But also the interesting note, and these students are very bright and they're very energetic about this issue. So right now it's cold, everything's frozen, and the prions are there. And then when it thaws out, they activate again. And they don't know quite yet if it spreads that way as well. So these are extremely tough. They might be tougher than the PFCs that are in my groundwater, Mr. Chair.
You know, they might actually be taking after them in the Minnesota mosquito as well.
Yeah, maybe, maybe. Yeah. So, but the important thing is I think that to Senator Simonson's point, I think when policies – recommendations come forward, that has to be part of it, not only from the I think that study, that information kind of has to be brought forward of what recommendations do we have to look at, either through the university and through preparing the carcasses and getting the venison out to everybody and making sure to proceed with caution on those. I think are all important policies that the department should be coming forward with soon.
So we'll finish with that. We're looking forward to the recommendations that you can give us some help so we can help you and continue to work on keeping our whitetail, managed for that tradition every year, and it starts in September. So thank you very much for the information today. And members, we stand adjourned.
Thank you.